This is VOA Asia Weekend. For the next 60 minutes, you're invited to join us for a look at the top news stories and features presented on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. As North Korea prepared to mark its 70th anniversary Sunday, the two Korean leaders, Kim Jong-un of the North and President Moon Jae-in of the South, were to meet for their third summit from September 18th to the 20th in the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. South Korea's National Security Advisor, Chung Yu-young, said Chairman Kim Jong-un, with whom he met Wednesday, reaffirmed his commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and to closely cooperate with both South Korea and the United States. The South Korean officials said the North Korean leader understands the process of denuclearization will not affect the status of U.S. troops in South Korea, that his faith in President Donald Trump is unchanged since their June summit in Singapore, and that he wants denuclearization complete by the end of Mr. Trump's first term in January of 2021. He said Mr. Kim also expressed a strong will carrying out more proactive measures if action is taken in response to the North's preemptive steps. These developments came just days before the North's anniversary ceremonies, with planned attendance by China's parliament chief, not President Xi Jinping. Korea Society's senior director, Stephen Norper, told VOA's Victor Beatty it appears a measured response by Beijing.
She has had three meetings with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, that after not having met him at all since Kim assumed power in 2011 and he assumed power in 2012. And so there was really a moribund relationship, but the fact that they've met three times is important. And the fact that he's sending one of the most senior people, the third-ranking party member, still shouldn't be overlooked. But it also shows a bit of restraint because he isn't coming himself, and that would have perhaps moved everything more into the China basket, but it's probably the best way for things to develop.
Can we say too much as far as speculation is concerned that this may be a sign of China's displeasure with North Korea's reluctance to denuclearize?
I wouldn't go that far. I think, if anything, China's moved into the North Korea corner. It and Russia have shown an amazing degree of receptivity to North Korean approaches. They seem to buy North Korea's line of having made some commitments and some early upfront measures by way of closing their nuclear test site as well as their testing moratorium. They would like to see the Americans do more. So right now you really have more of a division between those who are in the camp that includes Russia and China inciting more with North Korea and those like the United States who are concerned that not enough progress has been made on denuclearization.
Last week, President Trump tweeted that North Korea is, quote, under tremendous pressure from China because of our major trade disputes with the Chinese government. This is not helpful. China, of course, pushing back on that.
And Trump has basically said because of the trade disagreement, there's less cooperation on North Korea. You know, there's a bigger set of issues that also include the South China Sea, on which U.S. and China strongly disagree. And a lot of aspects of China's rise are things that don't sit well with the United States. But I think on the North Korea issue, they've argued for Chinese compliance. China did move forward in terms of the sanctions enforcement the latter part of last year, early this year. And we have seen a fall off in trade and economic relations. It's probably what brought North Korea to the table. But perhaps China's loosening too soon. Perhaps they interpreted the progress as more than the Americans think that it is. Perhaps they see some leveraging with the Americans by way of the North Koreans.
Stephen, just a moment, if you could reflect a bit on the 70th anniversary of the founding of North Korea.
Well, sure. It's significant in that it reminds us that we've had this dramatic standoff in the two Koreas, one democratic and prosperous in the South, one communist and an abuser of human rights, and a concern on proliferation fronts and by way of nuclear and missile development, as well as conventional forces in the North. It's a huge issue. It's the last of the Leninists. It's the remainder of the Cold War that needs to go this good night. But it's important, too, to remember that normally, if things had progressed as they were last year, there probably would have been tests associated with this anniversary, which is extremely important. But the North Koreans seem to be showing a level of restraint. Perhaps they realize that if they do test, that would just reinforce the U.S. position and irk the international community, and they may think there's more to be gained by having a more solemn celebration. It certainly will see military hardware and a large parade and these mass games, but it also shows that it's a better alternative than missile tests and nuclear tests, for certain.
Stephen Norper said South Korea is acting as both facilitator and moderator between North Korea and the U.S., a new role, but he said it also represents a high-risk position for President Moon, whose public standing among South Korean voters has fallen since this year's flurry of summits. But he said it's also important for North Korea to do what it can to keep public support high for the Moon administration, which it considers to be amenable. He said the North realizes it may have only a short window of opportunity to achieve its own goals of peace and prosperity. Doctors and scientists are now saying that unconventional weapons, possibly using microwaves, may have caused the symptoms and ailments reported by U.S. diplomats and their family members in Cuba and China. Initial results of some earlier research did not result in any substantial causes of the apparent attacks. At the request of the U.S. government, a medical team at the University of Pennsylvania examined many of the affected diplomats. I spoke with Douglas Smith, the study's lead author and director of the Center for Brain Injury and Repair at the University of Pennsylvania.
We were contacted by the State Department to take a look at this patient cohort, and so we agreed. I put together a team of experts in different disciplines, all around concussion type of treatment and evaluation, because that's what we surmise what the symptoms appeared like. And we learned pretty early on that while some patients were in contact with each other, others were not. So if it were mass hysteria, in theory, everything would have to be kind of cross-pollinated or contaminated, that they'd share stories and develop a kind of a scenario and a kind of a storyline. But that was not the case here. So there are individuals who did not know what the other individuals were experiencing as far as symptoms. The other important thing is that these symptoms are kind of complex. So this is very much like concussion. We sometimes call it concussion without the concussion, meaning that these individuals had no history of a head impact and yet displayed very similar symptoms to somebody who has persisting concussion difficulties. And that's things like troubles with cognition, how quickly they think, how they can remember words, can come up with a word, as well as balance and visual problems that were very characteristic of this group. Now, some of those tests you can't actually fake. Whether it was conscious or subconscious, you can't fake some of these types of tests on a neurological exam. So one by one, independently, the specialists examining this patient group were convinced, it's uniformly across everyone in our group, that this was indeed a neurological issue, a brain network disorder, and not a psychogenic type of change that originated because of some kind of mass hysteria type of event.
This has been reported, at least over the past couple of days, as being some kind of microwave attack. Did you confirm that?
No, we did not confirm that. So I think the New York Times ran a piece that seemed like a primary suspect to us, but on our side, we're not really the energy people, so we are aware of an extensive literature that where people have used different types of energies and directed them at the brains of animals in experimental studies and find that almost everything they test does cause a brain injury. And the list is not really long, and microwaves are on that list as part of a radio frequency exposure.
Are you aware of any such weapons, or whatever you would like to call it, that are in existence?
I don't know of those things. I think we're all aware of, maybe microwave type of beams that could take down a drone or some kind of aircraft. And, there are weapons that maybe could cause pain with microwaves, a burning sensation, which was not the case for this patient cohort. So, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but a lot of the energy sources, there always seems to be some kind of problem. From a medical perspective, we would be very curious of why it's selectively the brain and not peripheral nerves, not, tissue outside of the brain.
Is this damage uniform enough among your sample to come to the conclusion that a certain type of weapon or something that was similar, both in Cuba and China and maybe elsewhere, has been used?
We are currently evaluating what we call advanced neuroimaging to look at these brain pathways to see if there is a signature type of change in the brain. We're also joining with the National Institutes of Health to have what we call replication studies, so they can also look at the clinical data and neuroimaging to see if they concur and that we can work together on looking forward of developing what we would call an operational diagnostic criteria that we could, based on these different pieces of evidence, determine the specific signature of this newfound disorder. And finally, we're working with the Canadians as well, who have some cases there, so that we can compare notes between the findings in our cohort of Americans and their group of Canadians. I think that what we really need is to further the studies and try to understand what kind of exposure can cause changes in the brain that look very similar to what we see with concussion and yet not the head blow. In other words, what kind of, let's call it mechanical forces, can change the brain in a way that's ultimately very similar to a head blow, but there is no evidence of having that very large mechanical injury?
Dr. Douglas Smith, the study's lead author and director of the Center for Brain Injury and Repair at the University of Pennsylvania. A State Department official told VOA the health and well-being of our personnel remains our top priority. The investigation into the origin of these symptoms continues. The interagency community said the statement from the State Department is working diligently to determine the cause of the symptoms as well as to develop mitigation strategies. A group of 14 rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, has appealed to the giant search engine Google not to re-enter the Chinese market amid reports it's preparing to launch a censored version 8 years after leaving the country. In the open letter to Google's CEO Sundar Pichai, they warn the reversal of position would represent an alarming capitulation by accommodating what they call one of the world's most repressive internet censorship and surveillance regimes. In 2006, Google attempted to comply with China's censorship rules, but left the market in 2010. Now there are reports a new version of its search engine is being developed, codenamed Dragonfly, designed to be compatible with China's stringent laws and regulations. Human Rights Watch Asia Director Brad Adams told VOA's Victor Beatty, it appears Google is prepared to sacrifice its stated goal of giving as much information as possible to as many people as possible.
And they're sacrificing the idea of a free and open internet. Once you make a compromise with one of the world's global powers, you're going to end up in a lowest common denominator scenario where China will become the new normal for many countries around the world. Google has market power and the following to say no to China and therefore to say no to other smaller countries that don't have the same kind of leverage that China appears to now have over Google. So Google was able to do things like move its servers out of China to ensure that it was not ever subject to Chinese laws and then therefore Chinese orders to turn over material that they wouldn't turn over, for instance, in the United States. So we're going to have dueling internets. We're going to have a free internet for democracies, which will probably be slightly eroded over time as more authoritarian governments in the West try to argue that they should have the same access to information as China or the same right to censor. And then we'll have a highly regulated, controlled internet in China and other dictatorships.
Of course, Google hasn't confirmed its plans yet, but it's certainly a lucrative market, so it can hardly avoid not going back.
Google is already fabulously profitable. Its founders, Sergey Brin, who is a Russian immigrant, Larry Page, are gazillionaires. They have more money than anyone could ever spend in their lives. They do not need to make the extra money in China either as a corporation or as individuals. And they're sacrificing their principles and their reputation for, you know, as my family would say, a few shekels. And that doesn't make any sense. There's just no good reason to make this compromise because they already are dominant in the world, not in China, but dominant in the rest of the world. And there is no sign that, for instance, the Chinese search engines were going to displace Google anytime soon.
Is this a message also to other internet companies who want to do business in China?
Google has stood out and sort of held a line that some internet companies have tried to follow, and we could cite the Google standard to Microsoft, Yahoo, Cisco, and other companies that have made compromises in China, and they have been very uneasy, very defensive, and have always tried to point out the ways in which they tried to maintain control over their servers, to maintain user privacy, and to do as little censorship as possible. But, of course, that goal, that ideal that Google has set will now be lost.
Brad Adams said minutes of a meeting Sundar Pichai had with Google employees last week have been leaked and indicate a sizable number opposed to the reported move. He said many joined because of Google's founding motto, "Don't be evil." He said the company stands to lose a lot of good employees if it decides to re-enter the Chinese internet market, which he said is more censorious than ever. We're happy you're with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. One of the South Pacific's longest-serving leaders has said that climate change is an existential threat to island nations. Samoa's prime minister told a meeting in Australia that any world leader who denies the existence of climate change should be taken to a psychiatric facility. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Rising sea levels and erosion are threatening low-lying communities in the South Pacific. Some small islands have already disappeared in what many islanders consider to be the first signs that climate change has the power to overwhelm vulnerable areas. Speaking at the Lowy Institute, an independent think tank in Sydney, Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilaipe Sailele urged Australia to make deeper cuts to its carbon emissions to help protect Pacific Island nations. Australia is still highly dependent on coal for power generation and has some of the world's highest per capita levels of greenhouse gas pollution. Sailele said that warming temperatures pose an existential challenge to low-lying islands. He also criticised world leaders who deny the science of climate change.
We all know the solutions, and all that is left would be some political courage, some political guts. And any leader of those countries who believes that there is no climate change, I think he ought to be taken to a mental confinement. He is utter stupid.
The long-serving Samoan leader also said that Australia's attitudes to the South Pacific had been patronising and said despite China's growing diplomatic and commercial influence, the independence and autonomy of regional states should be respected. The Prime Minister's governing Human Rights Protection Party won a landslide victory in a parliamentary election in March 2016. The result confirmed Sailele's fifth term as leader. Samoa has a population of about 200,000 people. The archipelago was governed by New Zealand until a vote for independence in 1961. The mainstays of the economy are fishing and agriculture. Samoa lies about halfway between Hawaii and New Zealand in the South Pacific Ocean. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming your way on VOA Asia Weekend, South Korea's African farming legacy. India's Supreme Court has struck down a colonial-era law that criminalizes homosexual acts. The law was struck down in 2009 by the New Delhi High Court, but the judgment was overturned 4 years later by the Supreme Court. Reporter Anjana Pasricha was at the court when that decision was announced. VOA Sarah Williams asked her the reasons the Supreme Court gave for its decision.
Yes, I think the basic explanation is that this is against the Constitution because they said that the LGBT community has the same rights as any ordinary citizen. And respect for individual choice is the essence of liberty. You know, that those are the kind of words we used. And on that basis, they said criminalizing gay sex is irrational and indefensible. Basically, also, I think the basis for this was laid down last year when the Supreme Court delivered another landmark verdict, which was on privacy, where they upheld that individual choice is paramount, whether it is in matters of partnership or love or sex.
Well, now, this law apparently was from the colonial period when India was controlled by Britain. But since India has become independent, that law, though, still stayed in effect.
Absolutely. You know, I think initially no one really took the initiative to go to the court. The political parties also did not do it because this is in some ways also a very deeply conservative country. And there are a lot of people who still frown upon homosexuality. As a result, political parties were never wanted to take a stance on this issue. But finally, it was, I think, around the 80s and the 90s that activists took up the battle. It was a long, drawn-out battle. Initially, they won the fight in the Delhi High Court in 2009. But 4 years later, inexplicably to everyone's shock, the Supreme Court actually sort of scrapped what the Delhi High Court had said and reinstated the law, this colonial era law. But I think times have changed, even in the last 5 years since that 2013 verdict. And I think it's just the ruling for privacy also paved the way for this. And the gay rights activists were also much more aggressive this time in putting forth their right for constitutional, you know, rights.
What was the reaction when this was announced? I believe you were at the courthouse.
Yes, you know, I went to the court in the morning, anticipating, of course, that the community would be extremely anxious. From what the judges had said earlier, everyone knew that it was going to be scrapped. They'd given hints earlier. So there was a lot of optimism, but at the same time, they were very anxious because of what happened in 2013. So they were standing with banners. But, you know, when the verdict came out, it was announced in a packed courtroom. And, of course, it came out through media reports. I mean, people were just hugged each other. They cheered. Some simply broke down. I saw one person literally just sit on the ground, tears streaming down his eyes. Others were celebrating. A stranger came up and gave them flowers. They were really very heartwarming scenes.
Is there a feeling in India that perhaps this ruling in India might impact gay rights, for instance, in other countries in South Asia?
That is what I think the, you know, human rights activists are hoping. Human Rights Watch, for example, I think a spokesman today, Meenakshi Ganguly, she said that hopefully other countries will take the cue from this. Some countries in the region actually have very progressive laws. A small country like Nepal, for instance, it's much more progressive than India. But I think there are other countries like Pakistan, etc., where also gay sex is criminalized. And whether that's what human rights activists are hoping, but let's wait and see. I mean, as India, which is a big, vibrant democracy itself, it took so many years for this to happen. So it's not going to happen overnight, but yes, I guess the battle will be on as well.
Anjana Pasricha reporting from New Delhi, India. South Koreans have left an agricultural legacy in Africa as young people are returning to farms in South Sudan to empower themselves through food production. The country has been devastated by 5 years of conflict, which has left the agricultural sector struggling to feed the nation. Faith Lapidus reports on a vocational center teaching the new farmers skills to help them fill that need.
It's harvest time at the Hanbit Agricultural Training Center. It was established in 2015 by South Korean peacekeepers of the UN mission in Bor, South Sudan. The students are enrolled in a 3-month course to learn the skills they'll need to run a profitable farm business.
It is something good because the knowledge that we have acquired here, we are going to do it there in the community. Because when we will be delivered here, we are going to open up our farms, we dig and we cultivate our crops. Therefore, if we sold those crops, we are going to earn money. And that is a self-employment.
The students have cultivated a fast-growing species of maize and a variety of other crops, including celery and cucumbers. They learned irrigation technologies and how to set up greenhouses.
Now we are farmers. We planted some crops that gave us a good yield. It's not like before. The peacekeepers have really helped us here in South Sudan. With this training, we can help develop South Sudan. Each of us will go and farm in different villages and counties to help building the country.
Aid groups say almost two-thirds of South Sudanese will need food aid this year to stave off starvation and malnutrition blamed on famine and the civil war.
Conflict only brought poverty, but agriculture can bring welfare of the people. You can see that the communities are now working together here in Hanbit. So it's a sign that working together as a community through agriculture can eradicate conflicts and hunger at the same time.
The Hanbit Agricultural Training Center was established to build vocational skills, facilitate development, and foster reconciliation. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
We are happy you are with us. In Minnesota, Hmong farmers have banded together to make a better living. Originally from China, the Hmong are an Asian ethnic group that migrated to Vietnam and Laos in the 18th century, but they have never had a country of their own. After the Vietnam War ended, many resettled in the U.S., and now, decades later, Hmong farmers are at the center of a local foods economy in Minnesota. VOA's June So has more in this report, narrated by Carol Pearson.
On a Friday, Mi Hang picks flowers to sell at a local farmer's market over the weekend. Mao Mua and her husband pick vegetables, also for a farmer's market.
We bought corn, sweet potato, then gao cherry, cucumber, snap pea. Had a little bit of cherry tomato, that's all.
Hang and Mua's families were among a mass exodus of Hmong people fleeing Laos for Thailand in the 1970s. Ever since they resettled in the U.S., they have been farming in Minnesota in recent years on a membership farm.
I like farming on the Hafa farm because this is a Hmong association. There are Hmong workers who help us. They are like our hands, eyes, and ears. I like there is also water, electricity, and the food hub.
So happy.
Since 2011, the nonprofit Hmong American Farmers Association, also known as HAFA, runs the 63-hectare farm outside St. Paul, Minnesota. Member farmers have a long-term lease on 2 to 4 hectare parcels to grow their vegetables and flowers.
One of the reasons why HAFA was created was because the Hmong farmers were experiencing so much uncertainty, but they didn't always have access to land. So when you don't have land tenure or land certainty, you can't actually invest in organic certification. You can't invest in perennials, which actually have higher profit margins.
Paco Hang was born in a refugee camp in Thailand and came to the U.S. with her parents in 1976.
During the Vietnam War. In Laos, my father joined actually a secret army that was allied with the United States CIA. But when the Vietnam War ended and the communist faction came into power in Laos, they actually began to target Hmong soldiers.
With more than 60,000, Minnesota has the second largest Hmong population in the country.
Within the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Hmong farmers make up about 50% of all produce growers selling at the farmers markets. The Hmong growers' participation in the farmers market has really revitalized the farmers market.
HAFA also operates an alternative markets program called Food Hub.
Our Food Hub is a place where we aggregate our HAFA farmers' produce, and then we distribute it and sell it to different institutions, such as schools, co-ops, or restaurants. And then we also have a CSA program, or community-supported agriculture, that we have about 350 currently members that they get a weekly subscription of produce.
Hang says Hmong farmers have fueled a freshly grown local food movement.
Hmong farmers are major contributors to our local food economy and to our overall economy. I mean, studies have shown that they produce over $250 million in sales.
HAFA's business development programs help the farmers to get micro loans to buy tractors or new farming equipment. But Hang says all the programs are not just for income generation.
What we're really interested in, what we are focused on, is actually wealth creation. And not just intergenerational wealth, but community wealth.
For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Dakota County, Minnesota.
More than 100 hospitals across the United States are using virtual reality as a form of therapy for patients to help manage symptoms like pain and anxiety. An increasing number of countries worldwide are taking an interest in VR, and doctors are starting to develop international guidelines on how to apply and validate it in healthcare. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on a digital medicine leader in Los Angeles.
Amanda Green lives with pain.
If I don't have nerve pain, I might have joint pain. If I'm not having joint pain, I might have headaches.
The unrelenting pain is a symptom of lupus, an autoimmune disease where a patient's own immune system attacks the body. She participated in a study to see how VR can help with pain.
It worked. It works for me.
VR creates a distraction for her pain, and the content teaches her breathing techniques that also helps.
If it helps with the pain or not.
Brennan Spiegel, a gastroenterologist at Cedars-Sinai, says VR is more than just distraction.
Whoa.
He heads the hospital's virtual reality program.
Abdominal pain, discomfort, GI symptoms in some cases are related to mental state. The brain and the gut are constantly communicating. Something like virtual reality actually can intercede in the brain-gut axis and sort of rewire the neural circuitry in a way that helps to reduce abdominal pain. Virtual reality can reduce pain, can reduce blood pressure, and now we're looking to see, can it do really important things like reduce the need for opioids?
But could VR also be addictive?
We have not seen abuse amongst our patients who are using it for therapeutic purposes.
Spiegel is now taking virtual reality outside the hospital to partner clinics such as Attune Health, where many of the patients suffer from joint pain.
We're not just using it as a distraction method, but we are trying to train our patients in deep breathing and biofeedback.
The company Applied VR is developing content to have a VR pharmacy.
You need a wide variety of content because you have a wide variety of people in healthcare. You have infancy to geriatrics.
The aim is for patients to learn in virtual reality how to use their minds to manage pain and reproduce these skills in the real world. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Researchers worldwide have been searching for ways to reduce cattle emissions with various food additives. Dairy farms and other livestock operations are a major source of methane, a heat-trapping gas that contributes to global warming. Now, University of California researchers are feeding seaweed to dairy cows in an attempt to make the cattle more climate-friendly. VOA's Deborah Block has the story.
This is breakfast for these cows on a dairy farm at the University of California, Davis. They are getting an additional unusual ingredient in their food, seaweed.
We mix it with molasses, so it's a nice little sweet treat for them. We try to mix it as well as we can into their feed, but we have some cows that'll pick it out, and we have some cows that'll go right for the seaweed.
The researchers are studying whether small amounts of seaweed to cattle feed can help reduce the livestock's emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that's released when they burp, pass gas, or make manure. A dozen cows were fed ocean algae, which was mixed into their feed. Before feeding the seaweed to the cows, the researchers tested in this lab, where they can measure emissions in fermenters that simulate cattle stomachs.
And what we have basically here is six individual guts, and we can run them in parallel, and we can test the effect of different feed additives on the gut microbiology.
Milk samples are also tested for flavor and nutritional value. And the methane content of the cow's breath is measured when they stick their heads into these feeding machines. The researchers discovered that methane emissions were reduced by more than 30%.
And so far, it's very encouraging.
Dairy farms and other livestock operations are major sources of methane, and California is requiring them to cut those emissions by 40% by 2030.
Reducing methane ultimately means reducing greenhouse gases and reducing the impacts of climate change. So it affects everybody in the globe.
More studies are needed to determine the safety and effectiveness of the seaweed feed. Deborah Block, VOA News.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. The U.S. sharply condemned Monday's conviction of two Reuters journalists in Myanmar and their 7-year prison terms for violating that country's secrecy laws, calling it deeply troubling and a major setback in the Southeast Asian country's efforts to promote democratic reform. The U.S. Embassy in Myanmar, also known as Burma, said the clear flaws in the case against the journalist Wan Lon and Kyaw Soe Oo raise serious concerns about the rule of law and judicial independence in Myanmar. The two were covering the brutal military campaign in Rakhine State that has driven nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims across the border into Bangladesh since last August. They were focused on the massacre of 10 Rohingya by police and soldiers in the village of Indin. I spoke with Reuters editor-in-chief Stephen Adler about the verdict.
I was very disappointed with the verdict because there was really no evidence against them. All of the evidence suggested that they were innocent and that it was a blatant setup. So it was really upsetting and, though not surprising, because the fact that they were arrested and the fact that they were charged suggested that they were going to be convicted, because there was no evidence at any stage of the proceeding. There was no due process. There was no rule of law. So it was not that surprising that they were then convicted.
But this, everybody is saying, served as a possible statement that they were freeing things up as far as their government was concerned.
The fact that they were arrested under these circumstances, and we now know the arrest was a setup. A police captain testified at the trial that they had been instructed to provide documents to these two reporters and then to arrest them with the documents and claim that they had secret documents. And I think the goal was to stop them from reporting, but also to deter other journalists from looking too closely at what was going on.
Do you expect this to have a chilling effect on journalism, or do you think it might be the opposite?
It certainly isn't having a chilling effect on us. Even since they've been in prison, we published the story that they were working on that the government clearly didn't want published. And we've written four or five other, I think, very important investigative pieces in Myanmar. And I noticed that the global press is very much involved in covering what's going on there, covering what's happening in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. So I am concerned about the chilling effect on journalism in Myanmar. But I'd also note that reporters there have backed Wan Lon and Kyaw Soe Oo very strongly. They've come to court. They've rallied. They've demonstrated. They've worn T-shirts.
Have you been in touch with the two or any of them, either of them?
No, I'm not in a position from here to speak with them, but those of our staff who are on the ground see them as they come and go between the courthouse and the prison, and they've certainly spoken with them, and their families have spoken with them, and their spirits seem high. Wan Lon and Kyaw Soe Oo came out of the court today and said they weren't afraid. They knew they had done nothing wrong, and they were committed to seeing it through.
What about their families? How are they holding up?
I think naturally their families are very upset. Wan Lon and his wife just had a baby girl, and Kyaw Soe Oo has a three-year-old. So it's very hard on the families for the fathers to be separated not only from the wives but from these very young children. And the breakup of the families is one of the great tragedies of this. I think they're also holding up well.
Do you expect these prison terms to be fully carried out?
I certainly hope not. Our goal now would be to try very much to persuade and to bring about the a pardon or some sort of end to this. The government is in a position to end this case and to free them. And it would not in any way interfere with the court process because the process of the trial is over. We think that there's no time like the present to get them out. They've been in there for 9 months for doing absolutely nothing wrong except doing journalism in the public interest. So we very much don't want to allow a lot of time to pass. We see this as a matter of enormous urgency, and we hope people don't lose interest. Sometimes in these situations, people are interested for a while, and then they move on to something else. But this is one where we need sustained interest so that Wan Lon and Kyaw Soe Oo can go back to their families and go back to doing the jobs they are supposed to be doing.
Reuters editor-in-chief Stephen Adler. U.S. Ambassador Scott Marcel told VOA the verdict was sad for the journalist and their families, but moreover, he said, one has to ask whether this process will increase or decrease the confidence that the Myanmar people have in their justice system. The two journalists were arrested last December after meeting with two police officers at a restaurant in Yangon and given a stack of documents. They were charged with violating the Official Secrets Act, which was enacted in 1923 when Myanmar was called Burma and was under British colonial rule. Both men have denied asking for those documents. That court decision in Myanmar has triggered waves of outrage, both inside the country and abroad. The U.S. and the United Nations and other governments around the world say the sentence is a blow to Myanmar's transition from military rule and to freedom of the press worldwide. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from the State Department.
Family members of the two reporters were devastated by their seven-year sentence, but they put on a brave face for their sake.
We are still fighting for that, and we will keep on going. We have to make strong.
Hopes were high after Myanmar appeared to embrace democracy in 2016, naming formerly jailed opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi to be its civilian leader after decades of military rule. Attorney for the reporters warned the harsh sentence would have far-reaching consequences for the country formerly known as Burma.
This court conviction is not only bad for our clients, Hua Loan and Kwa So Oo, but it will also tarnish the country's image around the world. Consequently, it will have a negative impact on democratization, including rule of law and freedom of expression in the country.
The two journalists were covering the military attacks that have driven nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims from Rakhine State to cross the border into Bangladesh since last August. The United States is calling for the journalists' immediate and unconditional release, saying the verdict marks a sad day for press freedoms and the country.
So I think it's sad for people who've worked so hard here to promote media freedom.
Marcial said it would be up to the people of Myanmar to assess whether the sentence bolsters or diminishes their confidence in the country's justice system. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Maternal and infant health is an ongoing concern in the Rohingya refugee camps, where poverty and a lack of education can create health risks for new moms and their babies. Steve Sanford has this update after traveling with mobile health workers in the camps.
Every week, about 50 babies are born into dire conditions, with less than a quarter of deliveries completed in proper health facilities. Traditional norms and limited education have left many mothers with little knowledge of basic sexual and infant health care. Vital nutrition begins at birth, but many mothers are often unable to breastfeed because of stress and the consumption of poor food quality.
The child's condition today is getting better. We gave meds and nutritional food, and afterwards we measured the body, and there is growth. It's better than the first checkup. The child was in terrible condition when we first checked.
The mobile health workers also counsel young women about taboo sexual health issues, such as menstruation and contraceptives. During their first period, Rohingya girls are confined to their huts, and costly hygiene pads are not always available.
We have to use a clean rag to clean ourselves during our period, and after we finish, we then wash it out in a toilet.
But there are also new ideas that some of the experienced moms plan to pass on to their children.
The elderly tell us not to eat birth control pills or medicine to stop us from producing children. They say it's a sin to stop birth. We listen to them, and that's why we had more children in our family. But now we realize that it's not a good idea to have many children. Now I teach my children not to have more children and use birth control.
With the newfound knowledge of better hygiene, nutrition, and birth control, the next generation of Rohingya at least have a better understanding to face the future. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
China hosted a two-day triennial forum on Africa-China cooperation in Beijing, the seventh such meeting. Africa is recipient of billions from China's so-called Belt and Road Infrastructure Development Program. More than 50 African heads of state were in attendance. David Shin is a former diplomat and adjunct professor in international affairs at the George Washington University. VOA's Victor Beatty asked him if debt to China is a growing concern among these countries.
It is for some African countries, not all. It's 54 African countries. There are different debt situations in every one of them. There are several that, in fact, there are, I believe, five, according to the International Monetary Fund, that are now deeply indebted, and there are another 11 that are in strong threat of being deeply indebted. Now, not all of that debt, though, is with China. In fact, in most cases, most of the debt is not. It is with international financial institutions and other countries. China is the major debt holder in several of the countries. And in those countries, obviously, it is an issue of concern.
There was a recent situation involving Malaysia, not Africa, in which the prime minister canceled a $20 billion rail project last month because of the growing price of this relationship with China. Do some African countries view China that way?
Yeah, this has already happened in the last 5 years in several countries where loans have been scaled back or renegotiated in a couple of cases. It was the case in Ghana, also in Angola. Some of the African leaders realized that they've got to be more careful with debt. But as I say, it is important to look at where the debt is coming from. And in many cases, most of the debt is with other institutions or other countries.
China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi told his African counterparts on Sunday that President Xi Jinping will use the summit as an opportunity to outline a specific vision on building a China-Africa community with a shared future and announce proposals and measures to strengthen China-Africa cooperation. What does he mean?
The whole concept of the shared future is one of the new mantras of the Xi Jinping administration. And I think that means different things to different people. There will be very specific agreements that come out of this meeting in Beijing, as has been the case with all of the previous FOCAC meetings. But the whole concept of the shared values between China and Africa is a little fuzzier, and I think it really is in the mind of the beholder.
China's clout, of course, has grown exponentially over the years. According to Standard Bank Group's Asia operation, some 300 companies account for a majority of China's business activity, but the region also has some 30,000 smaller Chinese firms that are of growing importance. Obviously, China is having a huge influence on the continent.
This whole question of numbers of Chinese companies in Africa is an interesting one. I'm familiar with the report that you cite, the Standard Bank report, and you're quite right. They do indicate that there are as many as 30,000 Chinese companies in Africa. This is an estimate. Others have looked at this, and they have lower numbers than that. Actually, the government of China has a substantially lower number than 30,000. But it's possible that if you include all the Chinese restaurants and acupuncture operations involving one individual, you may get up to a number of 30,000. And it is, you're quite right, has a very important impact upon the continent. There certainly are more Chinese companies operating in Africa today than there are American companies.
David Shin said China's military base in the Horn of Africa country Djibouti, the first outside China, clearly shows its growing security interest on the continent. At the same time, he cautions China's clout in Africa can be overstated. For instance, he said China only represents about 5% of all foreign direct investment in Africa. Well, that is dwarfed by the combined investments of European countries and, to a lesser extent, that of the U.S. Still, China has become the continent's biggest bilateral trading partner. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Every culture has its own traditions for wedding ceremonies. Some throw massive parties and invite hundreds of guests, while others enjoy the occasion with close friends and family. In India and Pakistan, weddings can be very costly, and ancient cultural traditions like requiring a dowry can prevent girls from getting married due to family finances. Now a non-governmental organization in Srinagar, Kashmir, is helping Indian parents and couples lower the financial burden by organizing mass marriage events where over 100 couples tie the knot. VOA's Zubair Dar takes us to one of these joint ceremonies in this report narrated by Bisan Hamdar.
Weddings in Indian-administered Kashmir have become very expensive, and a common problem for many Kashmiri families is simply not being able to pay for it. In a region where marriages are commonly arranged by parents, it is becoming more and more difficult for them to afford suitable life partners for their sons and daughters. Now, a local non-governmental organization called Jafri Council has found a way to lower the cost by organizing a massive wedding for many couples at the same time.
We noticed that folks had unmarried sons and daughters over 30. We thought we should work on this.
In a single event, 105 Kashmiri couples tied the knot. And much like traditional weddings, couples' guests were present and attendees enjoyed music as well as Kashmiri cuisine. Sayyid Tanvir Hussain thought it was the best way to start married life.
The marriage ceremony went really well. I think that everyone should get married the way we got married.
In Kashmiri culture, a bride is expected to come with a dowry, usually in the form of money or jewelry. Newly married Fatima says this event is not only helping couples forego the financial burden, it can also play a role in ending an ancient tradition.
What the NGO is doing is really good. At least for the poor people, it is really good. The dowry system must end. So many educated girls are still unmarried in that home only because they can't afford dowry.
The average cost of a wedding in the region can run between $30,000 to $40,000. But the Jafri Council asks each family to pay just $700 to participate in the joint ceremony. Couples tying the knot here say that they can enjoy the marriage more by not having the stress of starting their life together with a large debt. For Yusuf Jamil in Srinagar, this is Bejan Hamdad, VOA News.
The United Nations considers marriage under the age of 18 to be a human rights violation. While the highest occurrence is in the least developed nations, including several areas of Asia, child marriage is also a reality in the United States. Researchers at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health found some 78,000 American children between 15 and 17 years old have recently been married. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on the effects of being married so young in the United States.
Sarah Tasneem was forced to grow up sooner than her peers. When she was 15, her father gave her to a 28-year-old man to be married.
My dad had become involved in a very kind of like, it's basically kind of like a cult, separate from like the religion of Islam, I think. It was your role as a girl that you would just, you know, be a wife and a mom.
Tasneem, who uses this name to protect her identity, said she was spiritually married to the man and taken away from her own family.
We left the country, went back to where he was originally from, and came back about 6 months later when I was pregnant and 16 years old, and we were legally married in Reno. I got really depressed, and I just remember seeing, like, you know, kids my age going to school and thinking, you know, I want to be one of those kids.
Tasneem's experience is not unique in the U.S. A study of data from the Census Bureau's American Community Survey finds that from 2010 to 2014, some 78,000 American children between 15 and 17 years old said they were married.
It's a problem because they're less likely to finish high school, 31% more likely to land in poverty in adulthood, and for girls, their health is threatened when they give birth young, and the health of their babies is threatened.
The data also shows an aspect of child marriage that sets the U.S. apart from other countries.
The boys are getting married young, too.
The study shows higher numbers of children of American Indian and Chinese descent were married. Immigrant children were more likely than U.S.-born children to have been married.
This is not unique to any one religion. There are child marriages across all ethnic groups and countries of origin, but those children who come from families that originated in Latin America, the Middle East, or East Asia do have higher rates. It is also the case that children whose parents were born here in the United States still have far higher rates than would be acceptable.
Tasneem had two children with her husband before she could get a divorce.
So I really felt robbed. I felt robbed of my education. And to this day, I'm still fighting to get my education back.
At 37 years old, her children are grown, and she recently remarried. But getting to this point has not been easy.
There's really no way to make somebody whole after, taking away their freedom.
Researchers say survivors' stories may help the public understand the effects of being married too young. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Scientists are using a new way to track animal species without having to capture them. Through a process called environmental DNA, scientists can now obtain the genetic trail animals leave behind, which could help to protect and save threatened species. VOA's Deborah Block tracks the details.
This is breakfast for these cows on a dairy farm at the University of California, Davis. They are getting an additional unusual ingredient in their food, seaweed.
We mix it with molasses, so it's a nice little sweet treat for them. We try to mix it as well as we can into their feed, but we have some cows that'll pick it out, and we have some cows that'll go right for the seaweed.
The researchers are studying whether small amounts of seaweed to cattle feed can help reduce the livestock's emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that's released when they burp, pass gas, or make manure. A dozen cows were fed ocean algae, which was mixed into their feed. Before feeding the seaweed to the cows, the researchers tested in this lab, where they can measure emissions in fermenters that simulate cattle stomachs.
And what we have basically here is six individual guts, and we can run them in parallel, and we can test the effect of different feed additives on the gut microbiology.
Milk samples are also tested for flavor and nutritional value. And the methane content of the cow's breath is measured when they stick their heads into these feeding machines. The researchers discovered that methane emissions were reduced by more than 30%.
And so far, it's very encouraging.
Dairy farms and other livestock operations are major sources of methane, and California is requiring them to cut those emissions by 40% by 2030.
Reducing methane ultimately means reducing greenhouse gases and reducing the impacts of climate change. So it affects everybody in the globe.
More studies are needed to determine the safety and effectiveness of the seaweed feed. Deborah Block, VOA News.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. A new study warns more than a quarter of the world's adult population, or 1.4 billion people, don't get enough physical exercise, putting themselves at great risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, dementia, some cancers, and other health problems. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of the World Health Organization report, the first study to estimate global physical activity trends over time.
The study, which surveyed nearly 2 million people in 168 countries, finds the level of physical inactivity has remained fairly static between 2001 and 2016. The World Health Organization says people are not moving around enough, and this is a cause for concern, especially among women who are less active than men in all regions of the world except for East and Southeast Asia. The report finds the levels of physical inactivity are more than twice as high in wealthy countries as they are in low-income countries. Lead author of the report, Regina Guthold, says the study also documents a wide range in levels of physical activity for countries across the globe.
Ranging from as low as 6% in Uganda and Mozambique to 67% in Kuwait. Four countries had a prevalence of inactivity of over 50%. That's Kuwait, American Samoa, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. And this all refers to the year 2016.
In explaining the difference, the report notes people in wealthier countries are more likely to engage in sedentary occupations, to use computers and digital devices for recreation, and to travel long distances. On the other hand, it says people in poorer countries do more physical labor and have less access to motorized transport. The report recommends people do at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity or 75 minutes of vigorous physical activity every week to stay healthy. It urges governments to provide and maintain infrastructure that promotes increased walking and cycling for transport, as well as sports and recreation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thank you for joining us on our journey through the past week on VOA Asia Weekend. You are invited to join us again next weekend.